Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you of the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And for the next hour, they're going to be those of Lieutenant Colonel Arthur Boyd, who has an amazing story to tell about a secret mission he was on during the Korean War. He's written a book called Operation Broken Reed, and, of course, he was ordered that he could not tell anything about this story until 1998. In other words, this was during the Korean War, 1951-1952, that he was recruited into this special operation, but this was to be top secret. No one, not even his wife, was to know. And, of course, had he ever revealed this, the secret, why, he could very well have ended up in Leavenworth, because, of course, when you are involved with a top-secret military operation, why, of course, you are not under any circumstances allowed to talk about it, but why for such a long period of time? And there's certain unanswered questions as to why these men were sent as they were and what they found. And certainly Colonel Boyd knows what they found, because he was actually chosen because he was an expert in encryption and transmission. He could do Morse code. But I'm going to let him tell this amazing story. Colonel, why don't you pick up the story as a young man, as a commissioned first lieutenant, working with the military in Germany, and a couple of years before I actually got over there as a medical officer. I went there in 54. You were there, of course, in what, 50, 51? Pick up the story.
Good to be with you this evening.
It's good to have you.
Well, my involvement, Dr. Stan, in one of the nation's most historically important and secretive military intelligence missions, kicked off on 25 August 1951. That is for me. I had a very plush assignment while serving as a lieutenant with an Army signal battalion stationed in Bavaria, Germany. During my leisure, I was happy eating German food and drinking 16% beer in a comfortable guest house. Now, the last place I wanted to visit in 1951 was halfway around the world where a deadly war had erupted. I recall it was my sixth wedding anniversary, and my wife, Nell, remained in Texas, and she was waiting rather impatiently for her port call to join me in Germany. Well, when I reported to Headquarters European Command for a rather highly classified special signal assignment interview, I was met by George Brown. Brown was a rather youthful full colonel from the Pentagon.
No, that wasn't his real name, though, was it?
Oh, no. No, I believe that this was an assumed name. Just as I found out that I would have an assumed name, too, my name would be changed to Mike Baker from Art Boyd, or from Lieutenant Arthur Boyd.
And, of course, then you were approached, and you were actually chosen out of the entire military because, of course, your expertise in Morse code. And, of course, you had the qualifications, and you were asked, of course, to volunteer for an operation that you knew nothing at all about. And, well, we're going to be back here in just a few moments with Colonel Boyd. But this really, of course, was one of those experiences. Well, a lot of people think it would be exciting. It was a terrible, terrible thing. But we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, Colonel, you pick up the story there.
Well, I found that Colonel Brown was searching for an individual, as you said a little earlier, individual experience in radio communications and cryptography, to fill a key slot within a 10-man military intelligence team. Well, that placed me dead center within Brown's crosshairs. Then after that, two intensive brain-racking days followed. During our first meeting, Brown hit me with the startling news that 10 Americans and 66 nationalist Chinese military were being selected to pull off an extremely dangerous intelligence operation behind the enemy lines in North Korea. I was really startled by the news that I met when I met him. My gut tightened up as Brown revealed rather an unprecedented multiplication of what President Harry Truman called, and I'll use his term, not mine, jackass mistakes and failures within the United States intelligence community. It was inconceivable to me that the intelligence mistakes at the highest command level were causing men to die unnecessarily, that the intelligence being fed to the president from General MacArthur's headquarters continued to be untruthful, unreliable, and distorted. But because the colonel was a smooth talker, I almost jumped out of my skin when he slammed his fist down on the conference table in front of me and shouted that the president had to know what was taking place above the 38th parallel. And he shouted to Brown, according to Brown, the senseless loss of our young men had to end. Well, after listening to Brown as a brief introduction, I was ready to turn tail, and I was ready to go back to my Bavarian hideaway. But Brown left no doubt in my mind at that time, Dr. Stan, that the mission would possibly be one of the most dangerous and bizarre military operations ever conceived. He wasn't naive. There had been an intelligence breakdown within the CIA, military commands throughout the Far East, and the failure threatened to lead to a larger and a more destructive war. It would plunge humanity, I have no doubt in my mind, into World War III and annihilation. The intelligence operations were broken, and they had to be fixed. So that was my initial encounter with our good Colonel Brown and my introduction to Operation Broken Reed.
All right, and of course, this was purely a volunteer operation, but there was little question in your mind that you were expected to take it, even though you were going to be a reluctant volunteer. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Yeah. Well, I was told that, you know, I could take a walk and I would continue on active duty, blah, 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 and on down the line. But I had a hunch, and I think I was right, that if I had not volunteered, I might very well kiss my career goodbye.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, anyway, Doctor, Colonel Boyd was approached by a man who called himself Colonel Brown. And, of course, he has said that he represented the President of the United States, and the President had to have a good intelligence from behind the lines in Korea. The Korean War was waging at that time, and of course, there was a great deal of frustration on the part of certain people in Washington, D.C., because General MacArthur had said, and I believe rightly so, that there was no way the Chinese communists could come into North Korea, basically, because their supply lines would be so vulnerable. It'd be very easy to bomb the single rail line up in Manchuria, bomb the bridges across the Yalu, and cut off the Chinese expeditionary force. No military commander in his right mind would possibly risk, you know, invading North Korea to take on the Americans, and yet that's exactly what had happened. And of course, President Truman was furious. He felt that the CIA had let him down, that the military intelligence had let him down. And so at his request, this special intelligence gathering operation was to be scheduled. And Lieutenant Colonel Boyd at that time, First Lieutenant Boyd, really realized that if he didn't go along with this, if he didn't volunteer, it could mean the end of his military career. So he did. He actually volunteered. And so you pick up the story there, Colonel.
Well, you know, you mentioned the CIA. As the war was progressing there, the CIA went to work, and they tried several methods of insertion of people behind the lines. Partisans were parachuted behind enemy lines from, would you believe it, from open bomb bays of American bombers. Others attempted to infiltrate through the battle line, and some were landed from submarine. Those brave men, Dr. Stan, faced almost certain capture or death. Most were never heard from after they went in. Some died while still hanging in their parachute harness. Both the enemy and the friendly forces killed many who tried to make it through the front lines. Others failed to reappear on beaches for scheduled pickup by submarines. There had to be another way, Dr. Stan. Truman secretly, as you said, brought together several trusted men to solve the Korean War intelligence dilemma, and he ordered those he had selected to come up with a plan. And within hours after the initial meeting, they decided that a black operation would provide needed intelligence on the enemy. Now, a black operation is an operation that, where it ends up really controlled by very few men. Very few know about it. There are no records which are permanent records or any kind of operational records that are kept. It is a need to be met, and planned to take care of that need. The plan that they came in with came up with the name of Operation Broken Reed, and that was under Truman's direction. And the term Broken Reed was actually Truman's personal choice, because its definition simply states that someone that fails or when they're relied on for support or help. And that really told the story, because Truman was not receiving good information or good intelligence. Most of it was distorted. Most of it was out of date by the time he got it. And full of a lot of presumptuous errors and what have you. And he wanted the truth, because he was not going to launch an all-out push to push the Communist Chinese back across the Yalu River unless he had information that would support the decision. So that's where we were at that particular juncture. And then I did volunteer, and you made a point of that. There was quite a briefing. The briefing was held at the headquarters European Command, and it was a very, very intense briefing. It lasted 2 days. At the end of 2 days, I was given an opportunity to, as I said earlier, to walk or to volunteer, and I volunteered.
And of course, you were also told that you might very well be captured and tortured, and so they put a cyanide pill in your shoe there, in your boot, so that
yes.
you could take that in case you
yeah.
were captured. Under no circumstances were you to be captured. But the one thing is that you didn't even know who the other people were. Everybody there used a false name.
Yeah,
nobody was know who was there, who was on the mission. It was all secret, even from one another. And so then, of course, they flew you to Japan, where you met the other members of the team. And were there 10 people altogether?
Well, there were 10 members of the team, and the 10 members of the team were supposedly men that bailed out of a B-29 bomber that went down over North Korea during December of 1951.
Now, this was a cover story.
That was our cover.
And, of course, what they were going to do was transport you across the Korean Peninsula from the east coast to the west coast. And you would have, of course, guards supposedly guarding you. But all the time, of course, this would all be designed so that you would be able to talk to the agents who were hidden behind the lines, collect intelligence, and then send it off to a plane circling overhead. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. There were 22 operatives that had been inserted into North Korea some 6 months earlier, 6 or 7 months earlier, during the summer of 51. And they had been there. They'd collected the information. They were able to infiltrate into enemy units and posing as replacement officers and staff officers and what have you. But they got themselves into a position to where they could gain the information that was needed. And they did so, and of course, then when we crossed the peninsula, there was rendezvous points as we crossed it from east to west, from the Sea of Japan to the Yellow Sea, and those points is where we were met during under darkness. We travel only at night, and those messages were handed to the CIA agents, who translated them from either North Korean or from the Korean language or from the Chinese language into the English language. They then gave it to me. I then had the job of encrypting that then transmitting it out. The transmission went out by half-frequency radio using international Morse code, and the messages were all in five-letter code groups. They were received by an airborne receiver, which was flying either over the Sea of Japan or over South Korea. And that was then taken to the Japan, where it went into the military communication system, transmitted, and straight to the Pentagon. From the Pentagon, rushed over to and put into the hands of the president.
Then, Chris, basically, your team, 10 people, 10 Americans, was inserted on the east coast of Korea.
That's true.
When you got there, there was a group of about 66 nationalist Chinese that were posing, of course, as communist Chinese. And they had a couple of tanks, they had a couple of half-tracks, they had a couple of vehicles. And there was a whole big convoy that was supposedly going to be taking these American prisoners who had been shot down, taking them over to the Yellow Sea, where they'd be then transported to China. That was the cover story, wasn't it?
That's exactly right. There were 10 vehicles, as you mentioned. There was some Chinese, there were three Chinese recon vehicles. There was a couple of Soviet T-34 tanks. There were two American half-tracks that had been modified and with a big red star on them. There were five Chinese wheeled vehicles, which were cargo vehicles, and then they were all put to a total of 12 vehicles and 66 nationalist Chinese manning them.
And, of course, this was a gigantic cover story. Supposedly, the Americans were prisoners there being transported across Korea. And you had all sorts of orders and papers in Chinese, so that if you were stopped, why you would, people would assume that the cover story was correct. Is that right?
Yes, those papers were very, very authentic in appearance, if not really authentic, period. They had been put together by one person that was in the high command. And access to doing so, and provided those things. And of course, as you moved along, and the different people stopped you in different checkpoints and what have you, those papers looked bona fide, and we were passed on from place to place. But that didn't work. That didn't work forever, I'll tell you.
Well, good, but it did work for how many days? How many days were you in transit across the...
Actually, we were in transit for 6 days. 5 days we had completed the mission. The 6 day is when all everything came apart.
Well, of course, now then the Chinese spies that were there, the North Korean spies, were meeting you as rendezvous points and transmitting information to you.
Well, what they did is they put the reports, their reports were in writing. And they were turned over to the CIA agents. The agents then transcribed it into the English language, and the English language then was encrypted into five-letter code groups, and that was transmitted out. And that was picked up from each one of these. There were 22 operatives that were inserted. We received 20 reports over the five-day period I mentioned. Those 20 reports contained the information concerning the enemy forces, their strength, their battle readiness, their attack plans and defense plans. Everything was laid out in these reports. Well, actually, the second day out, we received a report which really did startle me. I found out as I was going through the report, getting it ready for transmission, that there were Soviet bombers in Mukden, which is in Manchuria, that were armed with atomic weapons. And those were Soviet bombers manned by Soviet crews. And That really, really grabbed my attention. And I think that was probably one of the big factors that caused the president to do what he did later on.
In other words, of course, if the belief was, of course, that President Truman had really pushed and allowed the American military to do what they should have done, you realize that the General MacArthur, you've read his reminiscences, he wasn't even allowed to bomb the major supply depot in North Korea, where, of course, all the stores were, and wipe out the stores while you defeated the enemy. He wasn't allowed, of course, to bomb the bridges across the Yalu. He wasn't allowed to bomb the single-track railway in Manchuria. And, of course, an army has to have supplies. He could have stopped the supplies. He wasn't allowed to. And, of course, the question was, why wasn't he allowed to? And, of course, the presumption is, well, my goodness, if we fight the Chinese communists, why, we may get into a nuclear war because the Russian bombers are there. But this was the first inkling, of course, that President Truman had, that there really were Soviet bombers armed with nuclear weapons. Or at least this is the story that was transmitted back to the American forces from Lieutenant Colonel Boyd. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. And, Chris, this story about the Soviet bombers there, is there any way that we would know whether that was true or whether it was possibly feeding false information to the Americans? Do we have any way of knowing, really?
There was no way that I could authenticate it. My job was to do what I was put there to do, and that is to take the information which was handed to me by the CIA agents that were part of the crew. You mentioned that there were 10 men. Well, there were three Air Force. There was two CIA. There were two frogmen. There were two Army Rangers. And then there was a radio operator, and that's myself. And that was a composition. But the two CIA agents were the ones that took that information from the operatives at various rendezvous points, and then they processed it from that point. When I received it, my job was simply to encrypt it, to put it in the code, and then to transmit it out. I had enough to do. Those messages were not short messages. It took hours.
No, because the thing is that because there were everybody was there who supposedly had been on this plane that was shot down. It was a cover story. And actually, you had a different identity. What was your identity, and weren't you supposedly a sergeant in the Air Force?
I was a sergeant, Sergeant Michael Baker. Sergeant Michael Baker.
And so actually everybody had a cover story, so that you really never knew any of who these people were.
No, well, that Bill Robbins and Sam Puller were actual pilots of B-29, and that would authenticate if anyone started interrogating, knowing, you know, anything about the B-29. Well, Bill and Sam would authenticate that. Then there was Jim Pearson. Jim Pearson was a little guy, about 5'5", 5'6", little bit of guy. But anyway, he was a navigator, Air Force navigator. And his expertise, of course, on the convoy was to help if we should have to abandon that convoy to find our way back to where we need to go. And then, of course, the two CIA guys, Jerry Hensley and John Tyler, they knew their trade real well. John Tyler, I remember, was a man that was like an icicle. You really couldn't read very much by talking to him and by looking at him. And then the two frogmen, Tom Capeman and Reed Lynch, their job was to get us from that submarine onto shore. And then on the other end of the line, if we had to go by water after we reached the Yellow Sea, their job was to, you know, to take care of that. And then the two rangers, Dan Kingsley and Ted Moody, their job is, if we happen to have to abandon that convoy, their job was to find our way back through whatever terrain we were on, back to where we had friendly contact or contact friendly lines again. So everybody had a job. Everyone knew what they were supposed to do, and were very proficient in whatever assignment they had.
But of course, everybody knew this was an operation where, of course, you might not make it. You might very well die. And they were all appraised of that, weren't they?
Oh yeah. Well, it was emphasized. You know, from time to time, you'd get reminded of that. I was told that whenever I did the initial interview on the 26th day of August, 1951, that we had a 50-50 chance, or even worse a chance than that, of making it out alive. That was mentioned also as I was crossing the Atlantic, flying over to the United States.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is Lieutenant Colonel Arthur Boyd. He has been chosen as a young first lieutenant, actually bivouacked in Bavaria, and he's been chosen because of his expertise in encryption and Morse code and communications, and he is going to be the communications officer. There are 10 people. To this day, he doesn't know who any of them were, other than a couple of them were pilots, and one was a navigator. And the frogmen, of course, were there to get them ashore from the submarine that planted them on the east coast of Korea. The rangers were there to help try to get them out if something happened. And, of course, they've got 66 nationalist Chinese supposedly guarding. It's all a lie. Everything is a lie from the very beginning to try to get them from one end of the Korean Peninsula to the other, where they hopefully will be evacuated. But they would be collecting this information from the 21 operatives who had been parachuted or brought in by submarine. And, of course, all this information is going directly to the President of the United States. This is an awfully elaborate sort of situation. Why would they make it so elaborate? Why wouldn't they just send one or two people in to collect the information? Do you have any idea?
Well, they had tried that. The CIA, of course, had, as I mentioned earlier, had already tried several methods. They had airdropped guys in. They had taken them in by helicopter. They'd land them a submarine. They put them in through the lines. These guys didn't come back. They had to have some way to really provide a method by which the information could be collected and then processed and then transmitted out. And you can't process and transmit that out on a small, rinky-dinky, handheld radio. The unit I was using was a 100-watt transmitter, It had variable frequency oscillator. It was sophisticated. It was battery operated by a battery from the battery within the half track. And a good whip antenna up top side, so there was a clear shot to the aircraft flying overhead. Some guy going in with a handheld radio or some radio on his back would not be able to communicate too well out of that mountainous terrain. If you look at North Korea, it's 90% mountains. And if you're down in one of those valleys, your transmission doesn't go very far. It's pretty well cut off.
And so basically, of course, then there were five Americans in each half-track, and they were, of course, stopped repeatedly by the communist or by the North Korean troops questioning what you were doing. But usually, of course, the papers you were carrying got you through this. You actually had, of course, the equipment stashed and hidden in the half-track, and with instructions that if it looked like you were going to be intercepted, that you would actually, you had thermite bombs just to actually destroy everything, didn't you?
There were six thermite bombs, and the equipment that we just mentioned, the radio equipment and the crypto equipment, what have you, that was stashed underneath a fold-down seat, and when the seat fell folded down, it looked like it was welded in place. Like a welded seat inside of a box, so you couldn't imagine. And by the way, you couldn't get it up unless you knew where two hidden latches were. You'd have to know where those were to raise that thing up. Well, all these things were in the compartment inside of that. Well, if we were there, any danger of us being overtaken or having to abandon that vehicle, the thermite bombs, there were six of them, were placed over that equipment, and they were put into a timer activator, which was set for 6 minutes. When you tripped that 6 minutes, there was no way of stopping it. You had to bail out of that half-track, get out of there, because the thermite will melt the steel down to nothing. And, of course, the code equipment and the transmitters, the SOI, that's the signal operating instruction, the special SSI, special signal instruction, all that would be burned along with the equipment.
And so you're going up for maybe 5 days or so. Was it the fifth or the sixth day when you were actually stopped by?
Yeah, we were. Yeah, that's right. That particular was an episode in itself. We were stopped at a place called Onjin, O-N-G-J-I-N. That was the end of the fifth day. We spent the night there, and of course that's where we transmit the last transmission out. But we were approached, the convoy was approached by a senior military officer, and I think his intelligence from the Chinese.
Fine. It's, of course, he challenged the authenticity of the documents we're studying under. He wanted
right.
your a man who was the acting chief of this unit. He was actually a nationalist Chinese.
Yes,
officer.
Lieutenant Lee.
All right.
Yes.
And wanted him to go back to the headquarters. He wouldn't go. And so then, of course, what happened after that?
Well, after that, it wasn't very long until the three T-34 tanks showed up, and we made a run for it.
In other words, they sent some Soviet tanks in. They were going to stop you.
Yeah. And they took out the vehicles from the rear of the convoy, vehicle at a time, right up to where we were.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, our guest this evening, Lieutenant Colonel Arthur Boyd, and he's written a book called The Operation Broken Reed. And actually, of course, who picked that name for these operations, you know?
That was the president. At least that's what Brown told me. Brown said that he picked it because the name itself implied exactly what he wanted it to be. Someone or something that fails you when you really, really need it. And the intelligence community had failed the president. There's no doubt about that. He was not getting reliable information, timely information, and that's the way it was.
All right, fine. So basically, of course, you're on this operation. You're, your convoy is under attack, and they're knocking out the vehicles one at a time. They hit the vehicle, the half track behind you, that had, of course, the Americans in it, and they were all killed?
Yes. Two of them bailed out of the half track. I saw them. They're looked like their clothing was on fire, and they were gunned down before they reached the safety of a ditch.
And of course, all the 66 Chinese were fighting back, but of course they were no match for this.
No match whatsoever, because the automatic weapons and the main guns on those tanks. The tank hits you with a round that's HE on a wheel vehicle. It's gone. It is. It's finished. And anyone aboard on one of those, very, very likely they wouldn't survive.
So basically, did everybody get out of your half track?
Yeah.
No, did everybody get out of your half track, the fellows who
were there? No, my half track. I set the timer, and I gave the order, really, bail out, get out of here. The timer is going. And they got the hatch open on the rear. We were sitting at about a 40-degree angle in a ditch, and were able to get the hatch open. And, the first person to bail out this is a little tough for me. Ted Moody was a ranger, and he bailed out first along. He was hit after he went out, and hit through the neck. It took half of his neck off. Standing right beside me was Dan Kingsley. That was another ranger. And he had a round that hit him right in the forehead, to the left front of his forehead.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with... Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course Colonel Boyd is describing what happened. The convoy comes under attack. There's two half tracks, each carrying five Americans. There are 66 Chinese, and of course with this mechanized column that comes after them, why, of course, all of the 66 Chinese have come down. The five people in the previous half track, only two of them got out. Their clothes are on fire. Colonel Boyd, of course, at that time a lieutenant, sitting in this half-track in a ditch of listing 45 degrees, sets the thermite bombs to destroy all the equipment, orders everybody to get out of the tank. The first two people out, of course, got killed, both of them Rangers, and so now there's three of you, only three of you left. So pick up the story there.
That's right. Well, one of the three, of course, was Tom Capeman. Tom took a round in his left shoulder, which ripped the shoulder open and laid it open pretty well. And it didn't hit a major artery or anything like that, but he was bleeding pretty well. And the other fellow, I mentioned earlier Jim Pearson, the navigator, the little guy. Well, he hit his head on the inside of the bulkhead of that half track when the half track rolled, and he had a concussion. He was I had to shove him out of the half track, and I shoved him out over the body. Excuse me, over the body of Dan Kingsley, who had, when his head was hit, brains and blood and everything from his head splattered over my front, all the way from my chin to my knees. Well, anyway, we stepped over him. I shoved I shoved Jim Pearson out, and he was stumbling around outside when I was able to get out of the half track, and I had to tackle him because he was walking directly into the line of fire where they were firing directly up the road, and I was able to get him into the ditch and get around the half track, and we were lucky the three of us that got out of there. Lucky because the tank in front of us was burning and black smoke pouring out of the thing. And it was like having a smoke screen. It covered our getting out of there. And so made my way around with the other two guys around the half track, up a ditch, We were a couple hundred yards up the line, and then I looked back and saw all the guys that were all over the place. They were on the road. These are the Nationalist Chinese fellows and the two guys that had gotten out of the second half track. It was a horrible scene. Horrible scene.
And of course, but you were able to get off the road and get off in the thickets. Were there woods there? Were there?
Well, there wasn't any real thickets. There was a lot of scrub brush and rock outcrops and what have you and ditch. But we had cover enough that we made it up the ditch. But of course, by that time, Tom Capeman, who had been hit in the shoulder, was bleeding, and drops of blood was showing up on and by the way, it had snowed a little bit, and it wasn't very deep, but the blood was on the snow, so we knew that they could trace us. So we found a big outcrop of rocks and squinched down inside of it, and then I dressed the wounds. That's the first time I discovered that my left boot was full of blood. I had taken a round in my left lower leg, and it was a ricochet round. It didn't go very deep, about 3 inches at the most, but I was able to get it out, stuff it full of antibiotic and what have you, and tape it up real good so it stopped bleeding, and I was fortunate.
Now, of course, we're about 30 miles from your rendezvous point.
30 miles from the rendezvous point.
All right, fine. So the operation's over, and now it's just a matter to try to get out. You've got two badly wounded people with you, one confused, stumbling, and, of course, the other with a shoulder pretty well gone. And you're going to start moving then towards the coast with the hope that you're going to be able to be picked up. And then, of course, you come across, other patrols, communist patrols.
There were a number of patrols, and we lucked out initially because we could hear those guys, like they were a quarter of a mile or so away. We could hear them talking and laughing and what have you, and we found cover and let them go walking by. But then we went into a kind of a ravine where there was where the trail was cut into the side of a hill, and on the left-hand side was very, very deep ravine, maybe 100, 200 feet deep. On the right-hand side was nothing but sheer rock. And lo and behold, I heard another one coming, but the two guys with me were in no shape to take and, turn around and run, get back, find cover. And I was carrying the Browning automatic rifle in a sling, in a cradle position. And these guys came around, just turned in front of me, and there were five of them standing side by side walking, and they had their weapons in sling position. they weren't ready for anything. And they were talking and chatting, like out on a jolly walk someplace. Well, I clicked the safety off and raked from left to right and back again, and they all went down. And the young man on my right was trying to get up, a young Chinese fella. And I walked over and kneeled down beside him and picked him up in my arms. He was trying to say something, and I listened very closely. And he kept saying, "Yin Nin Ni." And he almost out of breath, and he said it over and over again. I found out that meant when I get back and talk to interpreter, he was telling me, he says, "I forgive you." He was saying, "I forgive you," over and over again, and he died in my arms. And we had to get on out of there. We pushed their bodies into the ravine.
Then you went off, and you were able actually then to contact. How did you get them, with flares or with radio? How did you attract them?
No, I mentioned earlier that there was an emergency kit. The emergency kit had first aid supplies, but it also had a very powerful light that was set up on a tripod. It was almost like one of those lights that you see in an optometrist's office where it projects the number of letters and everything up on a wall.
Right, right.
That sort of thing. You could not see the light from the side or from the back, but you could see it from the sea. So I aimed it toward the sea, and it had a manual key that I was able to operate, and I started sending SOS, and that was the night of the 17th when we arrived at the LSC pickup point. And I aimed it out toward the sea and hoped that you know, there was supposed to be a navy, a British warship. And I found out later that it's possibly the HMS Cardigan Bay that was spotted our thing, that SOS, right at dawn on the 18th, and called in a helicopter. The helicopter came from Seoul, or that Seoul area actually was down in Kimball Airfield, and picked us up off of that ledge, and we made it back. We were able to get out, but the other two guys. At that time, they couldn't even walk. They had had it. They were near death, and the last time I saw them was at the field hospital, and I don't know what happened after that. I pleaded with Brown to tell me what had happened to them, and he said, "Can't do it." He said that you know the rules.
And because the whole idea was that you were never to know who the other men were.
That's
right.
Course,
you were never to talk about this. And eventually, though, you did have a brief conversation with President Truman.
Yes, I did. That was at the debriefing, which was back at Camp Drake on the 20th of January. It was about a five-minute conversation, if you'd call it that. He did the talking and I did the listening. He thanked me for what I had done. And for what the men that for their sacrifice, and he promised me at that time. He says, "I said, Lieutenant. He says, I guarantee that you will stay or remain in the military service for as long as you want to, unless you're removed for just cause, which means that I would have had to be removed by court martial."
And of course, when you got back to your base, you couldn't even tell your wife it had happened. And
no.
Of course, your commanding officer there was wondering where you'd been. You were way overdue. You were 30 days there, and
it was a 30-day emergency leave. And I departed to Germany I departed my unit on the first day of January of 1952, and it was 68 days. When I returned, I had been absent for 68 days on a 30-day emergency leave. The extra time was covered pretty well by Department of Defense communication with my unit. But when I returned, my commanding officer really laced me good. He chewed me out. I think he was a professional at it. He did a good job of it. Within a week, he transferred me out of the unit. He called me a gold brick and many other words that I won't mention over the air. So,
and of course, you got a terrible efficiency rating as a result of that, which ordinarily
would
have pushed you out of the military.
It was an efficiency report, which was as low as it could go. And also, at that particular time, I had no college degree. I had a high school diploma. I'd gone to OCS at Fort Benning, Georgia, the first AOCC, the Army Officer Candidate Class Number 1, which was a combined officer class, and graduated in 1947, April of 47. So, I didn't have the degree that you should have. So, if you don't have a degree and you have a low AI, you're going to go out. And they had what is called at that particular time a RIF, reduction in force. That reduction in force meant that if you don't match this criteria, you're going to be discharged. Well, I expected to be discharged, but no. Lo and behold, I was promoted to captain, which is phenomenal. I visited the career branch a few years after that, and the officer I spoke with the career branch says, "How in the," and I won't use his language there, did you stay on the active duty? How did you get promoted?" And he was questioning, looking at my record, because by all rights, I should have been kicked out.
Well, of course, the president had promised you'd remain in, and of course, the military saw that you did, and you then served. How many years were you in the military
22.
Before you?
22 years. I retired in 1967, September 67.
All right, fine. And, of course, but this story, I mean, you really, this is a terribly traumatic episode. You couldn't even tell your wife. You couldn't tell anybody else. You were sworn to secrecy till 1998. And, of course, then, what happened when the time came and you wanted, of course, to tell the story?
Well, I wanted to make certain, first of all, that, you know, that maybe we better wait a little while. I waited a year, a little better than a year, after that time, and I decided, well, I'm going to let it out. I hadn't heard anything at all. So my wife and I sat down at the dining table, and I told her the story of Operation Broken Reed. And she was blown away by the whole thing. She said four words. She said, "Art, you need help." And help, I found help. I went to the Veterans Administration and started counseling with a Veterans Administration appointed psychiatrist for PTSD. And I also, in fact, today I met with Ronald Coffin, which is a counselor with the Knoxville Vet Center. And we spent an hour together. And it helps me keep my head screwed on right and, you know, keep functioning. And I'm getting on. I'm doing all right.
All right, Dad. You wrote the book then how long ago?
Well, the book actually started at the first thing I did was write an after-action report. Because, you know, in the military, you know how to do those things, particularly if you've written a few. I wrote an after-action report, and I thought, gee, you know, I want to find out if I can, whatever I can find out. So I had a meeting with John Duncan, a congressman from Tennessee, and I gave him that after-action report, and I asked him, I said, would you deliver this to the president? And he said, sure. And he did. And I thought, well, I'll hear something back from that for sure. Nothing ever came back. I have written a couple dozen people of high ranks all the way. All the presidents that were alive I received nothing back. Nothing from all of the agencies and everybody that I wrote. When I wrote the CIA under the Freedom of Information Act, I received a two-page letter back, and the two-page letter simply said, we can either confirm or deny that the mission did or did not take place. So, there I was.
But to this day, I mean, you wonder why, after all this time, they would want to keep this secret, you know, neither confirm nor deny. Obviously, they would know one way or the other if it ever took place, but obviously, they do not want the truth to come out, do they?
Well, apparently not after 46 years. I've asked the question, why top secret and why 46 years? Well, first of all, given that the United States was involved in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, it would have been very dangerous to make the operation known, just, you know, unclassified. And then secondly, revealing the operation would have placed any future special operations that we had in mind in jeopardy and placed our intelligence community in a very compromising situation. And then I thought of something else. That had the identity of the Korean War foreign operatives and supporters during the operation become known, now, these are foreign, these are people outside of our country, their lives and the lives of their families would be placed in jeopardy for as long as they lived. I mean, you have to consider those things. And then Truman circumvented the civilian and the military leaders in the planning and execution of Operation Broken Reed. He ignored the top military leaders, members of his own cabinet, members of Congress, the State Department, field commanders and staff, UN allies, and had OBR, the Operation Broken Reed, been compromised or revised, revealed to those, Truman would have incurred wrath and probably lost the loyalty and confidence of everybody. So he was in a tight spot there. He needed the information. He needed it without going through a lot of dallying around with different people, and he went direct to the source and got it. Of course, then there's another thing, too. After MacArthur was fired, Truman's approval rating hit rock bottom. You remember all of that. The public would doubtless have been up in arms had it discovered that our president had bypassed everyone in Washington, including the Congress, State Department, many of our top military leaders. So it was really a real big bag of problems.
Well, anyway, of course, you were there, an important part of history, and you've told the story. The book, incidentally, is available. Radio Liberty carries the book. Well, we think it's an important part of history. Operation Broken Reed by Lieutenant Colonel Arthur Boyd is available by calling 1-800-544-8927 and 1-800-5 HIV war. Do you have a website, Colonel, or anything?
No, I don't have a website. Certainly, if we want to communicate through you, you know how to reach me.
I certainly do. I should let our listeners know that we're the only people who have actually done any interviews. We did this is the third interview, but these were the first interviews that Colonel Boyd has ever done, telling the story of what happened in Operation Broken Reed. And we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, Colonel, what sort of response have you gotten, from the story as you put it out, and trying to get a book distributed is always very hard. Are you having an opportunity to tell this story very often, or really get the information out?
Well, I've had a lot of positive responses. If they go to Amazon.com, they can see all of the responses I've gotten, reviews and what have you. A lot of individual reviews from those that have read the story. But the reviews that really counted most with me are people that I have met and seen, and those that were in the Korean War, those that had something to do at that particular time, and to receive their thanks. And to know that I had a part in possibly saving the world from Holocaust, and that makes all the difference. It's been a tough year, tough half century, but I've endured, and I can be grateful that I was able to do what I did.
Well, I certainly appreciate it, and I know that our listeners will as well, because, of course, it was a very courageous thing to do. As far as you know, of course, you're the only one then that's still surviving, but there must have been other people within the military who knew about it. Have any of them come forward or tried to contact you?
No. I've had a couple of people that thought they knew what I would be able to gain some information from. But there are a number of personnel that, if they would, but think through it, the personnel that were responsible for the modification of the two half-tracks, those responsible for delivering the mission vehicles in North Korea, the Camp Drake personnel, the military police guards at Drake, logistical communications people, medical officer from the Korean MASH unit who instructed a team on the medical emergency equipment, the cooks and servers there at Drake, vehicle drivers, helicopter crews, the crew members of the aircraft that received the messages, and on, the fighter pilots who flew protective cover for the communications aircraft, pilots of two F-4U aircraft that made a bomb run on the convoy, and by the way, they missed. That was on January the 12th, and I'm thankful for that, because if that napalm had hit us, we'd been fried. Then there's the crew members of the Royal Navy warship that called in the helicopter, and there are a lot of people. The people at the Army Field Hospital at Operating Your Soul that treated three injured survivors that came in on 18 January 1952. The communications personnel that processed the information.
Well, of course,
a lot of people. And I'm looking and hoping that someone that is listening, someone that it will read.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Colonel. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Colonel Boyd is just saying he's hoping that some of the people who were involved with Operation Broken Reed with him will come forward. And you've actually gone into the ministry. Did you take a degree eventually?
Oh, yes. I felt called to the ministry. I went to Bethel Theological Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, a four-year seminary program. I graduated with a Master of Divinity. I went on to serve as a chaplain in two hospitals and an institutional chaplain, and that was another career, and found that was worthwhile. But it's something that I had difficulty dealing with, because every time I had a patient die on one of my wards or units, a lot of things flooded back, and eventually I had to walk away from that. I'm still ordained, and I'm still a minister of whatever God would have me to do.
All right. Well, Colonel, we're out of time, but God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us, and please keep in touch. We'd love to talk to you anytime, and anything ever does come up, please give us a call.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good night, sir. Bye-bye. All right, fine. And, of course, that was Lieutenant Colonel Arthur Boyd. We carry his book, Operation Broken Reed, or you'd like a copy of the program. But, you know, this story really, of course, so many unanswered questions. I mean, General MacArthur was not allowed to try to win the war. If you read his book, Reminiscences, you'll find out that they put the 7th Fleet between Taiwan and the mainland to protect the mainland, to protect the Chinese communists who were supposedly the enemy. We're sending our men, their men up into North Korea to kill our men. Certainly the fact that General MacArthur was not allowed not only to bomb the bridges across the Yalu, but to wipe out any of the electric generating plants in North Korea, to bomb the supply depot that was supplying the Chinese communists. And then, of course, the directive that he writes about in his book, you'll also read about it in General Willoughby's book, MacArthur's Rendezvous with History, from General Lin Piao, who headed the Chinese communist forces, saying, "I would never have risked my men and my reputation and attacked if I'd not been assured that Washington would restrain General MacArthur. If I had not been assured that Washington would restrain General MacArthur, Korea was a no-win war. Vietnam was a no-win war. We're fighting a no-win war in Afghanistan, where the American government's financing, the Pakistani government is financing the military intelligence that's financing the Taliban. Why would you do things like that? Because nothing is that appears to be." Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please go to our website at RadioLiberty.com and watch the videos that are listed there. Watch Building 7 come down and understand that when Building 7 of the World Trade Center come down, it was like no other collapse in all history. Watch it come down, realizing, of course, when you're doing a controlled demolition, the ceiling of the building caves in first, and then they destroy the base of the building so that the building will fall inwards rather than falling outwards. Watch Building 7 come down at RadioLiberty.com under other videos, and then read our newsletters and listen to our programs. You can listen 9 hours a day. We hope that many of you out there will, if you're up in the Spokane area, we're going to be actually up having a program there suddenly in the afternoon, at least we're hoping to. And if you can in any way help us financially, I would appreciate it. So we're going to be doing a weekend program as well. So if you'd like to help us, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. So we can get this program in the afternoon in Spokane and get other programs across America. We have to reach people with an understanding of the forces that are at work behind the scenes that you're never going to read about in your local newspaper, because the media is controlled in America. You read what you're supposed to. So, again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is RadioLiberty.com. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection, because we are on the front lines of a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You need to listen to our talk on the forbidden secret and the new one on secret knowledge. And we'll be back in just a moment for the next hour. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, formerly a senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now certainly a frequent guest on Radio Liberty and working with the Welch Foundation, writing a blog, authoring books. We carry his book, Liberty and Eclipse. But William certainly is an excellent observer of what's going on. It's always a pleasure to have him here. And so, William, thank you so very much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, thank you once again for having me.
Well, tell us what we're going to be talking about this evening.
We have to talk about the war in Georgia, in and around Georgia, and the fact that we're seeing what I believe to be a tropism toward a broader war through that entire region, expanding over, of course, from the Caucasus into the Persian Gulf and expanding from the Persian Gulf into Iran and heaven only knows where else. And I think that what we're seeing right now is sort of a prelude. We're hearing the grace notes of a much larger conflict that has been sown by some perfectly demented people, primarily in Washington and London, but also in places such as Moscow and Tel Aviv.
Oh, I think it's important that our listeners understand that Georgia is a surrogate of the United States.
Very much so.
We actually had our troops over there training the Georgians, and of course the Israelis, incidentally, had their troops over training the Georgians. We've seen that they've got the best military equipment. A lot of it came from Israel, but a lot of it came from America. And of course we've established this so-called anti- or communist or pro-Western government right on the edges of Russia. It really is a direct confrontation with Russia, and of course apparently when of course one of the provinces broke away, at least this is what we've heard, and perhaps you could clarify this, William, but that our leaders were encouraging the Georgians to take action, you know, knowing full well, of course, that the Russians were going to counter with military force. It doesn't make sense, but we've seen the same pattern used all over and over again, where we encourage people to do things that are illogical, and then it results in terrible, terrible violence.
Exactly.
You pick up the story there.
And that's exactly right. What you're seeing is sort of a Trans-Caucasian version of what used to be called before the betrayal of the Kurds and the Shiites in Iraq following the first Gulf War. The scenario was called the Baghdad Rules, where you encourage an uprising on the part of a certain group of people, and then you back away and let them get completely wiped out.
That's what we did in the case of the revolt in Hungary.
I was just going to say that it's right. The same level. It was called the Budapest Rules back in 1956 when the Eisenhower administration encouraged an uprising against the Soviet puppet regime in Hungary, and the CIA, of course, was on the ground abetting this and providing money and equipment and not military training, but equipment to propagate the revolution. And, of course, this served to surface those elements of Hungary society who were working to bring about a free, liberated Hungary that would be free of Soviet influence, and they were brought to the surface and wiped out. The same thing happened in 1991, 1992, 1994, 1995 in Iraq. And you're seeing a similar thing happening right now, but I think in this case the motives are much more cynical and really the objectives are much more diabolical. Way back in April you had this emergency summit that was called, during which Mr. Bush, speaking a script that was written for him by the adults who are his handlers, talked about the idea of bringing Georgia into NATO, and I think that the fuse was lit back then. That Putin, of course, was not going to permit Georgia to be brought into NATO, and some noises were made to the effect that the only conditions on which Georgia could be brought into the NATO alliance would be if they dealt with the separatist elements in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. And in order to do that, of course, you had to have training and equipment, logistical support, and that was all provided by the United States and by deniable elements of the Israeli military-industrial complex. Really, if you want to look at the relationship here between the United States and the Israeli government in this, it's somewhat akin to what the Brezhnevite Soviet Union did with Cuba back in the 1970s.
Hold that stuff right back. Go right ahead.
Yeah, back in the 1970s under Brezhnev, when he proclaimed the doctrine of universal socialist revolution, which is the exact corollary, the obverse of the Bush doctrine of universal democratic revolution, you had Cuba acting as this freelance agent of the Soviet Union, going hither and yon throughout Latin America and Africa and elsewhere, stirring up revolutions and providing people on the ground who would be trainers and often trigger pullers in the various revolutions. Of course, most notoriously, you had such things as the Angolan uprising, and you also had activities in the southern cone of Africa. What you got here is the same kind of a thing, with Israel playing the role of Cuba and Washington playing the role of the Brezhnevite Soviet Union, and Georgia being the puppet or the surrogate which is brought into this conflict with Russia. And of course, Putin knows how this game is played. He was on the other side during the last iteration of this great game between the United States and the then Soviet Union. And I suspect that what's happened is that for his own reasons, he has relished the opportunity for this conflict, because he saw the former Soviet Union becoming really the greater NATO alliance, the Warsaw Pact nations being picked up one by one into this NATO alliance, which really, by common reckoning, has no real purpose for existing anymore, because if the Soviet Union is indeed dead, and we sing dirges, or some people sing dirges, if we're really dead, we'll be singing celebratory choruses, 17, 18 years ago, when the hammer and sickle was run down in December 1991, we were told the Soviet Union was dead. If that's the case, NATO has no reason for existing by common reckoning. But NATO, more importantly than being an anti-communist alliance, was a regional affiliate of the United Nations system that is the apparatus of the power elite for organizing the world. And so these former Warsaw Pact nations were being absorbed into NATO, and plans were being made to absorb Georgia as soon as the vociferous elements within Georgia were put down by Saakashvili. And the thing is, Mr. Saakashvili is really a dictatorial, despotic figure. American-trained, American-educated, speaks English very fluently, is very close to the hardcore Trotskyite elements of the so-called neoconservative movement in the United States.
And he is the current dictator of Georgia. But
Georgia.
Of course, you can't tell the American people that, oh, this is democracy. No, he's not democratic at all. This is what the democracy always deteriorates into despotism. That's what Plato said.
Sure.
That's what's going on in Georgia. But we can't let the American people know that we're financing another dictator, as we're financing dictators all throughout the world.
That's exactly right. And the thing that I find interesting here is that it was about 2.5 or 3 years ago that, after he was brought to power through this so-called Rose Revolution, which was instigated by the International Endowment for Democracy.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here with William. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William's talking about the, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce his name, the current dictator of Georgia. English-speaking, trained back by our government. He's a ruthless dictator, just like all the other dictators that we're backing throughout the world, but we can't let the American people know that. We have to talk about the Rose Revolution. We have to talk about democracy. Isn't it wonderful we have a democratic regime in Georgia? We don't have a democratic regime any more than we have a democratic regime in Uzbekistan, which we backed, Kazakhstan, or any of these countries over there. And never forget for 1 minute, ladies and gentlemen, that it was your tax money that toppled the Shah in 1979 and brought the radical Ayatollah dictators to power in 79, and now we're threatening to go to war with them. Nothing as it appears to be. So let's get back to Georgia. Go right ahead, buddy.
Just in passing, you mentioned Uzbekistan, and I thought it was interesting that, what was it, 2-3 years ago, when Islam Karimov, who's the former commissar for the oil industry in that part of the former Soviet Union, now the reigning thug, was being hymned as a great Democrat. He was actually boiling people alive in oil. He was taking dissidents who were protesting his increasingly Stalinist rule. I mean, he'd reverted to type. He was not only a Leninist, not only a Marxist, he was a Stalinist. But he was taking these people and boiling in oil, and it took the really intrepid work of a very minor functionary in the British diplomatic corps in Uzbekistan to expose what was going on. He ended up losing his job over this issue, because the dogma coming out of Washington and London was that Mr. Karimov, if I remember his name correctly, was a valiant ally in the war on terrorism and a valiant ally in the global democratic revolution. The same sort of thing, although thankfully much less severe, has been going on in Georgia. You have this so-called Rose Revolution in 2003 that brought him to power. It was funded by the usual gang of Trotskyite fanatics at the International Endowment for Democracy, the International Republican Institute, the International Democratic Institute, and so on and so forth. By the way, it's not very well known that the Republican and Democrat parties, each of them has this huge slush fund that is provided to them by the International Endowment for Democracy that is channeled through these various institutes and used to organize political subversion of other countries. Most people don't understand that. They have sort of a parity relationship here where you have Democrat and Republican delegates, usually people who are part of the emeritus core of the bipartisan elite, who go to various countries supposedly to be election monitors, but before they show up, there are people on the ground working under the aegis of the International Endowment for Democracy to bring about these revolutions in various targeted countries. I mean, it's completely the opposite of what Washington talked about when he advised us to stay out of foreign entanglements, to leave the domestic affairs of other countries alone. Now these people who are animated by this vision, which is not all that different from the messianic evangelistic mission of old Brezhnevite communists, go out and foment revolutions and uprisings. They bring to power people like Saakashvili in Georgia, who now is ruling by decree since 2004, I believe. He's had the power summarily to imprison people. He has been conducting torture, albeit on a scale probably less extensive than that being conducted by Washington. He has been controlling the press. He's been imprisoning dissidents, and he's supposedly the great Democrat. Well, he launched a war of aggression about a week ago for the purpose of putting down a separatist movement in South Ossetia, which was primarily ethnic Russian. In doing so, he drew first blood about a week after his military ended the joint training exercise with over 1,000 U.S. military advisors for the purpose of teaching how to accomplish this type of an objective. He sent his troops into South Ossetia, killed 10 Russian troops who were there as part of a peace agreement that had been stationed there for over a decade and a half. There were civilian casualties. The numbers are probably never going to be known because the retaliatory attack from Russia ended up killing many, many more people than had been killed in this thrust by Georgian troops because Russia's got a much bigger and much more powerful military. But this is all something that was, I believe, very carefully planned and orchestrated, probably at least as far back as last April when talk was being bruited about bringing Georgia into NATO, and the idea being that there would be a firm plan in place by December of this year to bring Georgia into that alliance. Now, taking out of the equation the fact that Vladimir Putin, who's the real power behind President Medvedev in Russia right now, take out of the equation the fact that he's a career KGB agent, that he's somebody who is surrounded by what the Russians call siloviki, or strongmen from the military and intelligence background, and that he's somebody who at various times in his life had, you know, basically plighted his troth and literally taken an oath to advance Marxism as an ideology. Just take a look at this from the perspective of your common Russian. If you find yourself being surrounded by these powers that are part of an alliance, a mutual defense alliance, that implicates all of them in a struggle against Russia, should there be some kind of an incident, some kind of a border dispute, Article 5 of the NATO Charter implicates all members of the NATO alliance to come militarily to the aid of somebody who finds himself at war with another hostile foreign power, which means that if Georgia had been brought into NATO years ago, as many people suggest, many people have wanted, we would be at war with Russia right now. And the Russians tend to be a little bit better informed than most Americans on this subject. That's a prospect that, of course, most Russians don't find particularly appetizing.
And I mean, so the average American has no idea what's really going on. They don't understand that Georgia is a surrogate of the United States. And if I could just interrupt for a moment, I just wanted to point out that the major thrust of American foreign policy is not, of course, we want to neutralize Russia. The major thrust of American foreign policy is establishing a one-world government.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have troops stationed in 130 nations throughout the world. We have our troops stationed in Georgia. And in many of the countries in the Middle East, ruthless, tyrannical countries. But, of course, we keep our troops there to keep the ruthless tyrants in power. But these are ruthless tyrants who go along with our agenda of the world government. This is why we have over 700 military bases throughout the world. This is the ultimate foreign policy of the people who control both of our political parties, and they are using the financial and military power of the United States to bring about this one world government. And of course, for those of you who haven't read our material on Russia, why, of course, you'll find out that we have funded Russia right up to the various time. In fact, you can get a little pamphlet we put out recently on the Communist Capitalist Alliance with material from Solzhenitsyn and Professor Sutton pointing out how we have financed communism. And of course, you'll be pleased to know why. Of course, Russia is the major exporter of natural gas in the world and the second largest exporter of oil in the world. It's all oil wells that's your tax money through the Export-Import Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, American and other oil corporations. We've drilled all the wells for them. We finance these wells. We've made Russia the largest oil exporter since, of course, the so-called fall of the Soviet Union. And now, of course, we're on the verge of possibly an increasing conflict with that. It doesn't make sense unless, of course, you recognize that our leaders are always creating the best enemies, forming the best enemies, financing the best enemies that our money could buy. But pick the story up there, would it?
I think that's a very important element of the context here that most people don't appreciate. Even those people who are really paying attention to what's going on right now, of course, most people are fixated on the Olympics. And you had Mr. Bush over in Beijing staggering about pink-faced and disoriented as if he's probably reverted to his past performance as an alcoholic. Excuse me, looking every inch the superannuated frat boy with an idiot grin plastered on his face while American troops in Georgia were taking fire. There are at least two media reports that I've seen that talk about the possibility that American servicemen have actually been killed in some of the exchanges that took place in Georgia. Whether they were actually involved in the hostilities firsthand, I'm not sure. But I do know that there was one media report, I believe, by the BBC, where a witness talked about seeing people who were dead in black uniforms wearing American military emblems. And then, of course, there's concern about the fact that the military has had to airlift a number of Georgian troops out of Iraq back to Georgia because Georgia, to give you a really potent illustration of the fact that they are a surrogate of the United States, has the third largest national contingent of the remaining and ever-dwindling coalition of the willing in Iraq after the United States and Great Britain. And so you have the United States actively taking our own hostilities here because we were airlifting troops who would end up getting off our airlift vehicles and immediately start engaging in hostilities with the Russians. So really, when you look at it, it's not so much that we have yet to get involved in this war. We are involved in that war. And there's a possibility that American blood has been shed as a result of this. And yet, of course, you had, once again, this spectacle of Mr. Bush blithely bouncing around Beijing as if the world were his oyster and all was right with the world. And at the same time, you've got three task forces, carrier task forces, heading to the Persian Gulf, which, in my mind, betokens the possibility that what was going on here was that they were lighting a backfire so as to keep Russia occupied in its near abroad when the inevitable push for an airstrike against Iran begins sometime in the next maybe 4 or 6 weeks. I know that from reports I've read, people I've spoken to, that Kuwait is on a war footing right now anticipating a strike on Iraq, or strike on Iran rather, and retaliatory strikes by the Iranians, most likely in the form of activating elements that are very deeply networked in Iraq and probably in Iran, or in Kuwait as well. And so I really think when we talk about the possibility of this arc of crisis spreading to the Caucasus all the way through the Persian Gulf and up into Afghanistan, that's a very potent possibility here. We might be seeing not a Guns of August scenario like we had the better part of a century ago that led to World War I, but a tropism toward a broader war between the United States and a large portion of the Islamic world and a deepening conflict, albeit of a surrogate nature, with the only country on earth that could possibly do us harm right now, and that's nuclear-armed Russia.
And let me just point out that Iran is taking 320,000 graves. 320,000 graves. If you don't believe it, go up on the Internet and type in Iran 320,000 graves. Go right ahead, William.
Yeah, that's another element of this that has to be taken into account. Obviously, somebody has gotten a memo. Expect a rather large body count that will be compiled very quickly. And so I do think that, in a larger sense, we're going to find ourselves very soon involved in what could be described without hyperbole as a world war. And this, of course, would happen in the context of a presidential election in which it's becoming increasingly difficult for those of us who don't have the type of sophisticated instruments that such measurements would require to distinguish between the two major candidates on any matter of essential foreign policy or even domestic policy, for that matter. You've got in John McCain and Barack Obama, two people who are figureheads for two retail outlets for the same wholesale political establishment. Both of them have been making conspicuous noises of threatening warfare against Iran. Both of them have been very jingoistic in their treatment of Russia in this unfolding crisis in Georgia. Both of them seem to be advocates of a very expansive interventionist foreign policy. John McCain tends to support Thomas P.M. Barnett, the Pentagon futurist taxonomy. John McCain tends to favor the Leviathan force approach to conflict, which is to say, emphasizing the role of the military in killing people and breaking things, whereas Barack Obama is more of a soft power advocate. He prefers what Barnett calls the systems administrator approach, building alliances, working through multilateral organizations, engaging in nation-building for the purpose of integrating these countries more deeply into this global framework, this global architecture presided over by the United Nations, the World Trade Organization. And Dr. Stan, you're entirely correct. You talk about the drive of American foreign policy. It is not to contain Russia as such or to contain Beijing as such. The purpose of American foreign policy is to build the architecture of a one world order administered through these multilateral organizations on the assumption that this transnational elite, the dominant element of which still is found in Washington, would exercise hegemony over the world politically, militarily, economically, and although most people don't understand this, there's a religious subtext to this that's tremendously important. And so I think that when people take a look at this conflict, a lot of people who get their bearings on reality from talk radio, which of course is a terrible thing to do, unless you're listening to Radio Liberty, I hasten to add. If you're listening to any of the major talk radio personalities, you're probably going to hear treatment of this conflict that will look at it through the lens of a revanchist Soviet Russia reaching out and swatting a valiant ally of the United States. That's not at all what's going on here. What's going on here basically is you've got post-Soviet Russia and proto-Soviet Washington engaged in a type of pantomime or shadowboxing play that's going to advance the cause of globalization. Because on the one hand, Russia is comfortable working through the United Nations already. They've been exercising soft power through the Security Council of the United Nations. On the other hand, you've got Washington in the mode of bringing all of these fractious countries and breakaway republics into this architecture of the New World Order. And the dialectic here means that the solution is going to be found by enhancing the role of some kind of multilateral.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is William Grieg. We're simply talking about what's going on over there and certainly in the Middle East and, of course, extending up into the Caucasus. We're on the verge of a major international conflict, as William has pointed out. There are either two or three naval task forces. Now, that isn't simply a carrier. That's all the ships that go along with this, the submarines, all the other things that go with it. They're all moving towards the Persian Gulf at this time. And everything would suggest that there's going to be a conflict there. We've already commented on the fact that the Iranians are in the process of digging, or have done, dug 320,000 graves. Supposedly, they're telling the Iranian people that's where the soldiers are going to be invading their country, and don't believe that for a minute. They know there's going to be civilians. They can probably get three or four civilians into every grave, and they're expecting massive casualties. And this whole thing is being orchestrated and an awful lot of people are going to die, women and children and helpless civilians in the coming conflict. And of course, this is spreading certainly into the Caucasus area, increasingly unstable there. But you go ahead and pick up this story.
Well, I do think that we make the point insistently and consistently in this program that the mainstream media, as it's designated, is probably the world's worst means of acquiring useful knowledge about the world, apart, of course, from people who are paid shills for the establishment, such as some of these talk radio personalities I mentioned in the previous segment. But I have been really astonished by the fact that it's almost as if a switch had been thrown by an unseen hand, and the headlines that we're reading about what's going on in this conflict in Georgia make it look as if it's 1980 or 1979 once again, and you've got the Soviet Union rolling into Afghanistan. Not many people remember, and this is something that I learned tardily myself, we of course can stipulate to the fact that the Soviet Red Army did horrible, horrible things to the Afghans during the occupation that lasted for roughly a decade following the 1979 invasion, December of that year. Not many people recognize, of course, that this was something that reflected, once again, the efforts of Washington to create a pretext for a Soviet invasion. Does anybody remember this? You know, Zbigniew Brzezinski, working through the Carter White House, the National Security Advisor to Jimmy Carter, somebody who was a certified and pedigreed member of the establishment. David Rockefeller used him to create the Trilateral Commission. He's somebody who had a very internationalist outlook for his entire career before becoming Jimmy Carter's point man in foreign affairs. He has admitted that in 1978, he and a number of people in the CIA and other three-letter organizations and some shadowy organizations behind them connived to create this Islamic threat in Afghanistan on the assumption that they'd be able to lure the Russians into a Vietnam-type morass right there in their southern flank. And he was very proud of the fact that he helped create this pretext for the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. We've got really a striking parallel here, where the Bush administration has created, using this this pathetic little country of Georgia, which has suffered quite enough, thank you, over the last 70 or 80 years, over the last 20 years or so of ethnic strife and division and economic turmoil and so forth. Back in 1988, parenthetically, Mikhail Gorbachev, who's considered by many people to be a saint, set Spetsnaz and Soviet KGB commandos into Georgia to put down rebellion against continued Soviet rule of that country, and they killed hundreds of people. They used all kinds of dreadful weaponry. I mean, not merely firearms and explosives, but they also sharpened their shovels to where they were literally razor sharp instruments of mayhem. And they went through many of the cities where they were deployed, excuse me, wielding these like scythes and mowing people down. That happened in 1988. It was 20 years ago. So Georgia's had a lot of trouble already. But Washington, with a cynicism really that's quite breathtaking, used this country as a surrogate in order to provoke this Russian response, I believe, for a couple of reasons, the first of which is to keep it tied down, keep Russia tied down, in the event that we end up having this attack on Iran, which is very close to Moscow. And also, it turned world opinion against Moscow at a very critical time. That's a very important part of this equation. If you take a look at the press here in the United States and the press in Great Britain, it makes it look once again as if the Soviet Army, the Soviet Red Army, is on the march. The world is trembling at the prospect of the Bear Awakening. Nothing of that sort's going on here. I mean, there have been brutalities on both sides. Russia, of course, having a larger and stronger military, has probably racked up a far bigger body count than the Georgian forces being advised and equipped by the United States and irregular Israeli forces. But this is something, once again, that I think partakes of the nature of a stage play, and its purpose ultimately is to move us toward this conflict, this general conflict in the region, I believe, that will be the getter of many horrible things.
And of course, people have forgotten that it was the CIA that, of course, toppled the Shah, the pro-Western anti-communist Shah, and replaced him with the pro-Soviet Ayatollahs. That just doesn't make any sense, or does it?
Well,
well, Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Craig. I'll go right ahead. Wait a minute. Yeah.
You made a comment about how the CIA toppled the pro-Western Shah. Of course, that was after they had installed the pro-Western Shah way back in 1953, and when, I believe it was Mossadegh, who was a nationalist who, in contemporary terms, would be considered mildly socialist in his outlook, was replaced by that same CIA. And the thing I keep telling people when they talk about how we've been dealing with this Islamic radical movement now for many, many decades. A lot of people say we've been at war with Islam for decades. We just not realized it until September 11th how they drew first blood at various times. They attacked the Marine barracks in Lebanon in 1983. A couple of years after that, you had this horrible murder of Leon Klinghoffer aboard the Achille Lauro. You had the hijacking of the TWA flight that was held on the tarmac there in Beirut. We had embassy bombings in the late 1990s. We had the attack on the USS Cole in 2000. They talk about this whole history, but they don't start back in 1953, which was the first time the United States ever really got involved in any kind of a direct conflict in that part of the world on the side of the radical Islamic element. You have the CIA chumming the waters there in Iran by handing out money hand over fist to the most radical imams in Iran who would go about roiling up these mobs of people for the purpose of bringing down the government, installing the Shah. He actually had the chief imam in Iran deliver a religious ruling, a fatwa, saying it was permissible to overthrow the existing government and install a Shah. As a matter of fact, it was a matter of some moral urgency. And these are the same people who, 25 years later, were in the streets demanding the removal of the Shah and his replacement with the Ayatollah Khomeini. And so you had the CIA going out and siring these conflicts throughout the region for decades now. And I'd mentioned in the earlier segment the fact that in 1978, 1979, Washington created an uprising in Afghanistan that was seized upon by Moscow as a pretext to invade and remove one surrogate proxy government in Kabul with another one more to its liking. And then they got bogged down in Afghanistan for a decade and bled themselves dry, which was supposedly the intention of Washington. And now we see the same type of thing going on with Georgia, where Washington brought to power Saakashvili and then has supported him as he basically abolished civil liberties, instituted in his own limited way the type of executive dictatorship that the Bush administration obviously lusts to impose here in the United States. And he launched this attack on South Ossetia.
Now, hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with William Craig. Well, this is Dr. Stan. William was simply making the point that we had actually installed this a dictator in Georgia. He is a dictator. They do not have a democracy there. And, of course, but this is a pattern we see throughout the world as we install dictators in many countries, as we installed them at Fidel Castro in Cuba back in 1959. But, of course, we even have an interview with the American ambassador at that time, and you can see that on our video, The World Revolution, where Ambassador Smith will tell you how the State Department, the CIA, installed Fidel Castro, and they knew he was a communist tyrant. And of course, we do the same thing time and time and time again. And then we wonder why we have the problems we do. But before we go on with him, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your blog site and get your information.
I appreciate that. My blog is called Pro Libertate. I publish between 3 and 5 times a week as my schedule permits. Pro Libertate, of course, is a phrase that means for freedom, and that's the focus of the blog. I write about current events and historical matters occasionally, but always with an eye to what's going on right now with respect to the all-encompassing assault on individual human liberty and the dignity of the human individual as somebody created in the image of God. Pro Libertate can be found easily by Googling Pro Libertate and my last name, Grigg. That'll take you right there. Or you can go to the homepage of the Welch Foundation, which is called The Right Source. And the web address for that is www.rightsourceonline.com. It's one word, rightsourceonline.com. And if you go to the homepage of the Welch Foundation, there are two things you should do. The first of which is you should look at the top of the page, which has a banner ad for my new book, Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. You can order Liberty and Eclipse by clicking through at the top there at that banner ad, or you can order it from Radio Liberty, and it's also available from Amazon.com. Once again, the title of that book is Liberty in Eclipse, or you can scroll down about a third of the way down the page on the right source. Look at the left-hand side of the screen, and you'll see my photograph, and there's a hyperlink that will take you right to Pro Libertate. And once again, this blog that I write, Pro Libertate, is not like the common weblogs that you run into that many reporters maintain, that is sort of an open reporter's notebook or something to tease works in progress or paragraph-long observations on the antic passing scene. I use this as my primary outlet for what I did when I was with the New American Magazine, which is investigative journalism with a point of view. I like to call it investigative polemics, because I write editorials, I write opinion pieces, don't disguise my prejudices. My prejudices are all in favor of individual liberty and God's law. My purpose is to do journalism of first instance where possible, to find stories that have been ignored, find stories that haven't been reported, or to find stories that have been reported and to tease out of those stories some deeper understanding of what's really going on and how this illustrates larger trends with respect to the attack on freedom. And quite frankly, I don't write a lot of things that are of a hopeful or optimistic nature, not because I'm not hopeful and optimistic. A lot of people I talk to are surprised after reading what I write to find out that I'm not somebody whose habit it is to walk around in sackcloth and ashes. I'm actually a rather optimistic person. I'm just a realist about what's going on. To paraphrase Patrick Henry, I want to know the full truth. No matter how disagreeable it might be, no matter how discouraging it might be, I need to know the full truth. And the full truth is that liberty is nearly extinct in this country. It's not to say that we can't get up in the morning and do a lot of things that we would like to do. We have the same basic freedom of movement and freedom of decision that a lot of people enjoy in China, or in Iran, or in Cuba, or in North Korea. Problem is that in economic terms, in terms of what we can aspire to give to our children, in terms of what we control by way of our own property, what we control by way of our own labor, we're nowhere near as free as most people believe us to be. And the other thing that I constantly write about is how easy it is for people in this country who have done no injury to persons or property or even decent public order to find themselves on the receiving end of officially sanctioned violence by agents of the state in this country. That's the one element of this that I write about almost obsessively. People don't understand how easily one can find himself with a boot on the back of his neck, or looking down the barrel of a policeman's gun, or on the receiving end of a taser charge. It's very, very easy to do so without doing anything that would justify that type of violence. That's one of the leading indicators here of our descent into what I call the Homeland Security State. So, Pro Libertate, name of the blog, you can Google it along with my name, William Grigg, or you can go to rightsourceonline.com and link to it through the homepage of the Welch Foundation.
All right, fine, and certainly I recommend the material to you, and certainly we do carry the excellent book, Liberty and Eclipse. So, let's get back to what you were talking about what's going on over there in the middle, in the Caucasus area.
Well, the thing that I want to advert to once again is the near identity here in the worldviews between classic expansionist Soviet colonial policy of the 1970s and what the neocons have called the Global Democratic Revolution. We don't hear a whole lot about the Global Democratic Revolution nowadays because it had become a bit of a political embarrassment for the Bush administration, given that Iraq had become really mired in internecine fighting, intercommunal warfare, and given the fact that they've not yet been able to export their revolution to Iran, which they clearly intemperately lust to do. But still, they're proceeding on the assumption that it is the mission of Washington everywhere and always to be involved in everybody's quarrels and to direct them in a certain fashion that would lead them to certain political outcomes. And as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, the ultimate objective, of course, is to plug them all into the framework of international order. I want to go back and talk once again just very briefly about something I adverted to in an earlier segment tonight and something I talked about last week, which is this concept of the Pentagon's new map by Thomas P.M. Barnett. He's a fellow about my age. He's a Pentagon futurist. He's somebody who's considered to be one of the top 50 or 100 thinkers alive today. He writes a syndicated column. I can't remember for which news service. But he was the guy who devised this idea that the world should be divided, not between North and South, which is, of course, the liberal way of looking at things. There's the wealthy, developed North and the developing South, or the underdeveloped South, and not between East and West, because that's, of course, archaic now that supposedly the Soviet Union has collapsed. No, the world should be divided between what he calls the global core and the non-integrating gap. And the core nations would be those that are plugged into this apparatus of world government through the United Nations and the World Trade Organization. And I want to italicize something that's very important. In terms of the actual impact on the lives of people, in terms of what they make, what they can save, what they can earn, their standard of living, it's the World Trade Organization that really is more important than the United Nations in terms of what it's doing right now. The United Nations, in principle, is a very important thing. I don't want to disparage those who understand that. But the World Trade Organization is actually in the business of deciding and allocating, in many ways, deciding which nations are going to be able to keep some element of what their people earn, and the trade policies that will bring about prosperity or misery for hundreds of millions or billions of people. That's what the World Trade Organization is involved in. And Thomas P.M. Burnett, I think, is really interesting. This guy is a certified globalist. He really emphasizes the idea of getting people plugged specifically into the World Trade Organization. Just by way of a brief digression, here in the part of the country I live in a little town called Piatt, Idaho, which is just across the border from Oregon. It's the beautiful place called the Treasure Valley. And one of the big cash crops here is sugar. Sugar is something that, of course, has been regulated. The price has been kept artificially high by the United States government for many, many decades as a result of New Deal interventions in the economy. And there's a headline in the local paper here talking about the fact that pursuant to policies that are being dictated by these multilateral trade organizations, Washington's talking about importing more foreign sugar. Now, they had created these artificial protectionist walls to protect the domestic sugar industry for decades. Now they're letting them down, and the result is going to be they're going to wipe out the livelihoods of I don't know how many thousands of people here in this part of the western United States, but also throughout the entire country. You're going to have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, for all I know, millions of jobs that are going to be wiped out because, for whimsical reasons rooted in international trade policy, the government of the United States is going to end its protectionist policies, which admittedly it shouldn't have had in the first place. But they create the problem, and then they create a solution which makes the problem worse through these trade policies. Well, that's a good illustration of the type of consequence that flows from these interventionist trade policies that are maintained at a global level. And Thomas P.M. Burnett and his map of the world, dividing the world between the integrated core and the non-integrating gap, really emphasizes the idea of trade policy and WTO membership as one of the qualifications for being a member of the core, the global core. Now, his idea is that we're going to be fighting wars now, probably for decades on end, and staging occupations for the purpose of bullying countries into integrating with the global core. And that was the real purpose of the war in Iraq, according to Thomas P.M. Burnett's analysis.
And I really think that's really quite true. I think that, of course, Saddam Hussein thought he ran the country. And
yes,
he didn't understand, of course, that you do not, you know, fight City Hall. And we wanted to bring not only Saddam, but all of the Muslim world under the control of these people who are into these this idea of global government. This is what it was really all about. And anybody who stands in the way can anticipate either being assassinated or having their country attacked and being replaced. This is the real reason we have troops in 130 nations throughout the world, but we can't tell the American people that because most of them really don't believe in globalism. They believe in America. They want to maintain our sovereignty. But the small elite who rules and controls both parties here has a different worldview because they have a different because I believe they worship a different God. But go right ahead.
One of the interesting things that happened as a result of this Iraq war, this is something Burnett had predicted. He said, really, the coming war with Iraq, he was writing this in 2002, I think, late 2002, the coming war with Iraq is going to compel the United States to come to grips with its obligations in building this administered world, this UN-administered world. And so the real target of the war in Iraq was the American people and the attitudes and concepts and mindset of the American people with respect to what we are told are our global responsibilities here. And that's the type of rhetoric that you heard infused into a lot of the speeches by Bush and the policymakers at the time, and is something that resonated with a lot of the think tank verbiage that was extruded by the likes of the American Enterprise Institute and by journals such as the Weekly Standard and other neocon broadsheets and propaganda organs. And more importantly, it's something that became part of the common conversation because of the popularizers, and to mention names specifically, people such as Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, were recapitulating this message in terms that made them more popular, more accessible to the NASCAR cohort of our population, or to the type of people who consider themselves reasonably well-informed because they listen to talk radio for several hours a day. They would talk about the supposed fact that Saddam Hussein could not be permitted to thumb his nose at the United Nations, could not be permitted to ignore his responsibility to obey Security Council resolutions. I actually heard Mr. Hannity, in a fit of contrived and theatrical hyperbolic outrage, because Saddam Hussein's actions in defying the United Nations meant that the Security Council resolutions weren't worth the paper they were printed on. And I found myself utterly nonplussed by this. I said, it's really become an interesting situation, an interesting turn of events has occurred, when populist conservatism now consists of being willing to shed blood, both foreign and American, in order to enforce United Nations Security Council resolutions. But that was the type of quantum leap in the direction of a globalist mindset that Thomas P.M. Barnett anticipated when he was writing about the Pentagon's new map and the idea that the Iraq War would change the mindset of the American decision-making class, but also the American people, in the direction of embracing this set of global responsibilities. You know, Ambrose Bierce famously said that war is God's way of teaching Americans geography, because were it not for the fact that we get involved in these distant lands, we'd never learn about them. And of course, we're likely to see a geography lesson here. We're undergoing a species of geography lesson due to the fact that we had American advisors in Georgia. They've been there since 1992. We'd lost our first Green Beret advisors as early as 1993, if I remember correctly. But what is happening is that it's also being used as a way of teaching Americans the vocabulary of globalism. And this is something that not many people recognize or understand. The much-derided so-called isolationist element of the conservative movement, Pat Buchanan, Ron Paul, used to be called the Robert Taft wing of that movement, always talked about the idea of fighting wars to win and then coming home, and only fighting when we had to in order to defend our country, and to do so through the strict application of the constitutional method, which is to say Congress declares war, it empowers the president to prosecute the war, and then you end the war, and then we return to normalcy, because we're not supposed to be a militarist nation. We're not supposed to be permanently mobilized for the purpose of warfare. That, of course, is exactly the same type of conservatism that the late, and I believe sainted, Alexander Solzhenitsyn embraced for Russia. If you read his writings about how Russia ended up in the trouble it was in, he would point to the fact that for several hundred years under a succession of rulers, going all the way back to Peter the Great, you had Russia constantly intervening in the affairs of other countries. You know, from Poland, which was its historic enemy, its most important historic enemy, all the way down to the Caucasus and into the region of the world we're now getting ourselves mired into, you know, places like Afghanistan. And what Solzhenitsyn said was, we should never have intervened in these matters. We should have let them tend to their own affairs. We should have worked to build Russia. We should have worked to ensure that the values that define Russia as an Orthodox Christian nation are preserved, and we should have recognized that getting involved in these silly military excursions created an undertow that sucked our culture down with it. And the result was catastrophe. The result was that we were fatally weakened and we succumbed to this devouring bacillus that is communism. He identified that as how that country succumbed to this dread disease of totalitarianism. Well, folks, the same thing is happening here in the United States. People are caught in this undertow, and the whirlpool is accelerating. We see that the war in Iraq, spending $1 trillion on this idiotic venture, is ruining our economy. People are paying the price for it, although there's not been a direct tax levied. People are paying the price economically for that war. We see that the culture is being coarsened in ways that are both subtle and alarming. We take a look at the fact that torture is now institutionalized, and this is something that purported Christians will endorse as a matter of warfare and a matter of national policy.
Of course, they tell us that we're involved in a just war, so it's all right. I mean, as long as it's
sure.
a just war, it's all right to torture innocent people. And I wonder how many Christians have ever stopped to think of the men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And
exactly.
there is a very structured evil at the highest levels of our government today that seems to have a different worldview, a different agenda than the average American. And our job is to get that information out. Certainly our guest has been William Grieg. Always a pleasure. And hang on there for William. Don't hang up. We're going to just wrap up the program here in just a moment, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up tonight's program, as always.
Well, Dr. Stan, what we're discussing this evening, we talk about these people who are animated by a different vision of God and a different vision of man. I mean, what you believe about God will inform how you look upon man. If you believe that there is no God, that we're the result of some kind of chance mutation in a primordial slime pit or some bizarre random collision of matter set in motion by forces that are completely impersonal, then you're not going to believe that there is a standard fixed canon of moral behavior, obviously, and you're not going to believe that other people are innately valuable. You believe that God created each of us in his image, that by leaving that impress on each of us, he certified that each of us is valuable in his sight. If you believe that, then there are certain things that will follow about how you will treat your fellow man. And this reciprocal relationship of rights under God's law that is the foundation of all civilized life, whether you're talking about the American concept or whether you're talking about the way that we treat people in other countries by way of our foreign policy. But we're talking about the breakers of nations. Not only are we talking about those who liquidate other human beings for sport, it seems, but more importantly, for the sake of these grand designs, that they are people who uproot cultures. They break nations on the wheel of their ambition, and they're doing that right now in Georgia. They're preparing to do it in the Middle East, in Iran. They've already done it in Iraq, of course. Iraq was an artificial nation created by those people about 8 decades ago by drawing a line on a map. But more importantly, they're doing it to the United States. They're breaking us in a way that is much more devious than anything they could do with matters of simple geography. They're breaking our nation in terms of what we mean to ourselves, what our concept of this country is morally, and the foundation of the system of order, liberty that we should espouse, embrace, and protect. We are being broken by virtue of the foreign escapades these people have arranged. Solzhenitsyn observed that's how Russia was brought down into the living hell of totalitarianism. We're following the same trajectory unless we stop it right now.
I agree with you totally, and this is why I do what I do. I know that's why you do what you do. I guess it's been William Grieg who's been talking something about the tragedy that is unfolding in Georgia. I mean, 3 weeks ago, if you told anybody in America there was going to be a war in Georgia, people would have said that's absurd. I mean, our attention, we're focused on other things. But you must understand that our reality is created, our tastes are formed, our concepts are created by people we seldom even know exist. William, thank you so very much for being with us. We'll look
thank
forward
you.
To talking to you again. Our guests are going to be with us tomorrow.
God bless.
God bless. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we hope you always enjoy William Grieg. I know I always do. He's a fascinating individual, and certainly we're privileged to have him here as a regular guest on Radio Liberty. We are moving into difficult times. Of course, if you've not yet heard our talk on Iraq, The Untold Story, let me suggest it's an excellent DVD. And then the most important thing is there's a syllabus that goes with that. And that syllabus will explain to you so many of the things. It has a lot of original documents you will never see elsewhere. And, of course, the Iraq, The Untold Story, we recommend it to you. All of the wars of the past century and the century and a quarter have been contrived, as is the current wars that we're becoming involved in. So if you'd like to get Iraq the Untold Story or any of the other material we have, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, or 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today. Let me just mention, of course, we're having our all-day conference. It's going to be on the 26th of October. Dr. Blaylock will be here, of course, talking on health issues. Joanna Michelson, who had been a medium, is going to be here, telling you about her experiences dealing with the other dimension. Then, of course, we're going to have Patrick Wood talking on finance. It's going to be a great time. Michael Shaw will be with us. And if you're interested in coming, why, of course, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. We have to know how many people are coming because we're serving lunch, and it's always a good time. But set aside October the 26th. If you can come from out across America or wherever you are, this is a lovely time up here to be in the North Shore of Monterey Bay. And then, of course, we also want to mention certainly the book, my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. I'm going to be giving a talk on that later this week back in Virginia at the camp there. We'll be flying back on Thursday, and we'll be there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. If you'd like more information, you can call our 800 number, and Mary can tell you the people to be in touch with who are going to be putting the camp meeting on. Supposedly, there's going to be 300 or 400 people there. At least we hope there will be. It's a long way to go. But then, of course, we also want, of course, remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and if you're in a position to help us, we'd love to hear from you. We actually are going to be hopefully having an afternoon program, a new program in Spokane on a major station there, and a weekend program in Spokane as well, be heard on all the American Christian Network outlets. And so if there's any way you could help us with that, if you're in a position to help, well, we'd love to hear from you. Again, our number 1-800-544-8927. What we need to do, of course, is to expand our coverage, because I think that the guests we have here have tremendous insight into what's really going on in the world, and nothing is and appears to be. There really are secret societies. There have been secret societies since the beginning of time, and there have been men who've been moving towards a common goal, but we live at the most fascinating time in history, because many of the things that have been known in the past would never be discussed publicly. The secret knowledge that has been passed down for centuries has always been concealed, and yet now we find it being popularized by Oprah Winfrey and by Larry King. Rhonda Burns has written a book called The Secret. They've sold, I don't know, 5, 7, 8 million copies of that. Her DVD, The Secret, 3 or 4 million copies of that. You need to understand that she reveals what the secret is. She tells you there's a power out there that you can tap into. She tells you that you can change the world with your mind and your outlook. She tells you the secret that you are God. Now, that may sound absurd to you, but if you understand there really are people, millions of people who believe that they are really under, they have the ability to change the world. And the trouble is, they really do, as long as they maintain their allegiance to the spiritual forces out there, to the other dimension. But let me warn you, do not, under any circumstances, I think that you can play with these spiritual powers and survive with your soul intact. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our website, RadioLiberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty.